They don't know you can't do discovery. All right? So you do discovery anyway. The attorneys don't know the difference. And if they don't object, makes it okay. All right? So you do discovery. And you try to get whatever evidence that they have. Well, what if they don't produce the evidence? Well, basically, what you do is you say, wait a minute, this is contrary to the rules of fair play. Because everybody is supposed to be able to see all the evidence first. How you interpret the evidence is a whole different game. That you're not entitled to see until the moment of trial. Okay? Strategy is secret, but the evidence itself must be presented, must be released. Okay, so no discovery against you because you presented all the evidence. But on the other side, they're being secretive. So you ask for the evidence. They refuse to produce it. They drag their feet. They just ignore your request for it. So now you have a choice. You can either just go ahead and have trial by surprise, where you go there and then they pop with the evidence, but that's kind of a bad way to run a trial. Or the other thing is you could say, you could go to the court and you say to the court, hey, this is unfair. I asked for the evidence. They're playing games. They're dragging their feet. They want to do trial by surprise. And I think I should have a fair opportunity to look at the evidence. So now you have a choice. You can ask the court to force them to produce the evidence or be in contempt of court and ask for sanctions because they refuse to produce the evidence. But I consider that a bad way to go because usually the evidence is in their favor. Why would you want them to bring the evidence in if you think it's going to work against you? So what you do, get to you, and what you do is you go the opposite. You say, because they refused, I want an order blocking them from producing the evidence. Okay? Forget it. They can't produce it. Okay? They're not allowed to produce it even if they have it. And that particular kind of motion has a name. It's called a motion in limine. In other words, you're limiting the evidence. Okay? Again, it's just a motion. All right? You're going to the court. You're asking the court to order these guys blocked. Yay or nay, right? That's it. So let's look at a motion in limine. Pardon? Yeah.
Yeah, in respect to this evidence, mm-hmm. you also talked about strategy. Let's say you had evidence and documents
that were put together of, let's say, 200 pages, which are at attachment.
Sure.
You take these 200 pages and you mix them all up, not in chronological order that you would do for yourself, and you hand it to them, this is the evidence.
Yeah, now that's up to them to sort it out.
That's strategy, right?
Yeah.
Good.
Now, you're not mixing the pages and they're trying to figure out which page goes with which.
Yes,
that.
Yes.
No.
Oh, okay.
No.
I just wonder how far this fair play went.
You don't go that far, but, you know, each piece is intact. This is the evidence. You know, whatever it is, but you let them sort out what's the best order of presentation or what, let them guess what you're going to do. But I sure like that. Bye. Bye. You know, what a strategy. Powerful, you know? Really strikes at the gut. Yes, sir.
Trying to think.
All right, we'll take this one here.
Is there a counter?
A counter?
How could they counter that?
Well, yes, as a matter of fact, the motion in limine is right here in Matthew's. And when Bender puts together these things, they deal with successful cases. These are motions that worked, okay? And they take both sides. There's the offense and the defense, all right? So let's look up motion in limine since we're talking about it. Uh-oh. All right, let's see. We'll go to the folder. Okay. Here it is. Motion in limine. Oh, I misspelled this. In limine. Yeah. I'll have to straighten that out. Hopefully that'll be straightened out before you get your copy. Let's take a look at it. Okay. So Matthew Bender's... Now, I'm going to show you some of the features of Matthew Bender's book here. First, they give you the scope. This is to give you an idea of what it encompasses there. So this chapter discusses the motion in limine and its use in civil actions and contains forms of motion and an order granting a motion in limine. That's form ones and form two. So they actually give you forms. Okay? And they have cross references. For discussion and forms relating to motions in general, see chapter 372, motions and orders. And by the way, I've included that. Okay. For a discussion of pretrial conferences at which motions in limine may be considered, see chapter 425, pretrial proceedings, which I did not include in there. For a discussion of pretrial motions to suppress prejudicial matter in criminal proceedings, such as motions under Penal Code section 1538.5 of Gearings, see Irwin, Millman, Monroe, Sevilla, Tarlo, California Criminal Defense Practice, chapter 23, which is, I guess, published by Matthew Bender. And so these are suggestions, you know, for particular types of cases. All right, so now they give you some education. This is the beauty of it. They give you some education, so you have some idea what they're doing. Okay, governing law. A motion in limine, while common, is not specifically authorized or governed by any California statute. A trial court's consideration of such a motion, however, appears to be authorized under Code of Civil Procedure, section 128A3. In Gearings, and so on, which states that every court has the power to provide for the orderly conduct of proceedings before it and to amend and control its process and orders to make them conform to law and justice. And justice. Got that? That's where discretion creeps in. You don't want discretion. Keep that a court of record. Remember that. You're the court. But anyway, additional support for a motion in limine is provided by Evidence Code Section 350, which allows the admission of relevant evidence only, and by Evidence Code 352, which authorizes exclusion of unduly prejudicial evidence. To me, unduly prejudicial evidence means you might win if you show it. Okay, or they might win if they show it, and the judge is there to control the evidence that reaches the tribunal. All right? And I think you're familiar with abuse of that. You've seen that. So, but anyway, so in other words, there's a whole section there that describes the process. Okay, the concepts, the legal. You get a little legal education. It's like a little mini course in that particular subject. Okay, then they give you some definitions. In limine is defined as on or at the threshold, at the very beginning, preliminarily. Okay, at the limit, in other words. A motion in limine is a motion directed to the judge outside the presence of the jury to limit or exclude certain evidence or testimony in anticipation of such references by adverse counsel or witnesses. Such a motion generally is brought at the beginning of trial, although it also may be brought during trial. Okay, so that gives you an idea of where it gets used. What's the purpose of the motion? The usual purpose of a motion in limine is to preclude the presentation of evidence deemed inadmissible and prejudicial by the moving party. The scope of a motion in limine is any kind of evidence that could be objected to at trial, either as irrelevant or subject to discretionary exclusion, as unduly prejudicial. Okay, a typical order in limine excludes the challenged evidence and directs counsel, parties, and witnesses not to refer to the excluded matters during trial, and so forth. So, now... You notice they use the word unduly, okay? Well, duly, the word duly, D-U-L-Y, means that whatever it is that's duly satisfies the requirements of both the statutory law and the common law. Duly includes both systems of law. Mm. When something, if you were duly given a receipt, that means that action of giving you the receipt will meet the requirements of both statutory and common law. Okay? So watch out when you use the word duly, because you are including the statutory law that you are excluding when you're running your common law case. Okay? Don't just throw words around until you've checked the legal meaning. All right? You can get trapped. And I don't like you guys to be trapped. So, we time out for tape change here. We got a little tape change working. Yeah, there's one right here. Unduly means that it would be offensive to both the common law and the statutory law. It's unduly prejudicial. That would offend both the common law jury and a and a statutory jury, or a common law court and a statutory court. That's what that unduly means to me. The prefix un reverses the meaning, right?
Un is away from, out of.
Yeah. So, anyway, they describe in Matthew, Benders, they describe the purpose of the motion. So you get a picture. This is really, this is good stuff. It really educates you. So I'm going to skip down to the next part. There's a lot there. See, they do a lot of explaining. You're getting a little mini course in law. So let's see. Appeal. And they talk about appeal after judgment and so forth. Then they give you research guides, places you can look for more information. You remember I got a question earlier. How do you find this stuff? Now you know. Seek and ye shall find. Okay? And this is one of the tremendous resources. But there's other tremendous resources too. So when you go to the library, the librarian will be just like the clerk to say, well, I can't advise you on law. Okay? But if you ask the librarian, where could I find information on blah, blah, blah? Then he will not advise, but he will suggest. Suggesting and advising are two different things. He will suggest certain books to look at, but you take the responsibility of looking into the books, okay?
Hey, Bill.
Yes.
I noticed some of your work,
you take a word like duly, and then you explain how you're using it in that case. I noticed in the bottom of the page how you did that.
You mean footnotes?
Yeah, I remember you used duly and put a footnote because it meant something for this page or that word in that
well,
case.
Well, you see, one of the rules of good legal work is know thy enemy. Okay? So I know where my enemy is ignorant. And I know what they know. I've studied my enemy. How did I study them? Real simple. I opened up Black's Law Dictionary, 5th edition. It's full of policy and very little law. I look up 4th edition. It's full of law and very little policy. Okay? I got the two side by side. I do compare. I look at this one. I look at the same word in the other one. It's amazing you see the differences. One of the principal things that's stripped out of 5th edition is common law. There's a lot in there still, but a lot is stripped out. That's how I get to know the enemy. Because I know the attorneys, it takes a long time for information to get to the dictionary. It also takes the same amount of time for ignorance to reach the dictionary. And so I know that the current crop of attorneys I'm dealing with, they grew up on something in the schools, which by the time they got out to practice, showed up in the dictionaries that they're using. The latest, greatest, best dictionary. They're on top of it. They have the best of everything, right? They put their money into the best dictionaries, the latest one. The problem is that they don't understand how their mind is being controlled by the available information. They don't know the old books can be better sometimes. Okay? And they don't know to have an 1828 Webster's Dictionary. Okay? So that you know thy enemy. And when I put a footnote on like that, it's because there's a point I know they're ignorant of, and I want them to be educated on that point. You see? So that's when I put the footnotes in. I'm not just randomly educating them. There's a reason I put it there. It's because once they understand what I'm saying, then that in some way is going to affect another thing downstream. Okay? Now, they may skip over it and never read it. That's okay too, because later on downstream, when I make the point, I can refer to this, and remember, failure to object means you agree, right?
That's right.
I do that a lot, yes, sir.
Does that CD have both 4th and 5th edition?
I can't hear you.
Does the CD have both editions, 4th and 5th? On it?
No. There's Black's Law Dictionary does not appear on this CD.
Oh, okay.
What do I have? I have Bouvier's Law Dictionary on there. That has real law in it. And that's the 1857 edition, I think. Yes, sir.
If I wanted to specialize in writing this, a habeas corpus, writs of prohibition,
and Mr. Mandana, what would be the very, very best book that you'd recommend?
Well, the first thing that I'd recommend, or if I want to really be technical because I'm in this group that knows the difference, the first book that I would suggest is reading that law note about habeas corpus explaining the concept that I explained verbally about the two sets of courts and how one court takes from the other court and, you know, takes jurisdiction. That's very, very important because you will not find that in any of your books. I got that out of my study of history, legal history. Okay? Well, I read up on habeas corpus and found out from the pages and the pieces of information that came out that was really the story. It was a turf protection tool rather than an actual great writ of liberty. It was the great writ of turf protection. So once you understand that principle, then when you do your research and you pick up on all these things, you'll fit them in a different paradigm. Paradigm meaning a foundation.
We're talking about the great writ now. In Europe, there was 27 countries just signed a new constitution. Was the great writ removed? Because now they're operating under the UK.
I've never looked at that constitution.
It's brand new. It just came.
Yeah, right.
Just signed.
I know there was a lot of argument about it. They actually signed it now. All 27 signed on?
Yes, and is the great writ lost?
There's no jury built into that system, you notice.
I know, it's horrible,
yeah.
Evil.
Well, that's to bring okay. It'll evolve into a dictatorship. You know, that's what they do. So, I mean, that's historically true.
Wow.
And the United States is doing a similar thing.
And the great writ is lost. Will it be lost here if they pull this off? They're trying to. That's what Bush wants to do is...
Well, what they want to do is they want to convert us over to the Roman civil law system. That's why they're stripping the common law out of all the reference books. They still have a problem changing the Constitution, though. See, that's what's stopping them. And if you've got the law, well, then you have the legal power.
But all those 27 countries' constitutions been stripped.
Well, we're not part of them.
I know, but imagine that. The Great Rip does no longer exist, I think.
Well, that's the problem that people are going to have to deal with over there. You know?
Aren't they stripping the Constitution by treaties?
No, the treaties, any treaties that the United States signs with other countries, according to the Constitution, become the law of the land. However, they do not overrule the Constitution. You cannot amend the Constitution by treaty. Okay? It still has to meet the constitutional test. Just because it's a treaty does not automatically mean it supersedes the Constitution. And I have yet to see any treaty that supersedes the fundamental foundation of the Constitution, which is the preamble, which says the people own the government, right? That's the highest authority. They're going to have to change the preamble. By the way, I suggest just, you know, if you want a little entertainment, a little, if you have curiosity, you ought to read the Mexican Constitution. They do have English versions, okay? They actually recognize in the Constitution openly the difference between people and citizens.
Wow.
Yeah, there is a difference. I mean, it's because they are a republic. You see, Mexico, the formal name of Mexico is the United States of Mexico.
Right.
And so, and they are a republic, just like we are. That means the people are sovereign, even in Mexico. And in fact, anyone... The Khomeini, Ayatollah Khomeini, when he was alive, he was charged with the responsibility of determining what form of government would be. I guess it's Iran, is it? And he chose a Republican form of government. Why? Well, it goes back to the people own the government owns the citizens. So a Republican form of government in one circumstance can be the great liberator that frees everyone, you know, because by being a people, whatever the people decide, either directly or through representatives, becomes only advisory to other sovereigns. After all, if you're going to be a sovereign, that means you cannot be controlled. Excuse me. On the other hand, if you successfully complete what they're trying to do in the United States, which is they're trying to dumb down American education, convince everybody they're citizens, give them absolutely no knowledge of the separate status of people versus citizens. What happens is that now a Republican form of government can become the worst form of government, because what happens is the elite are educated, understand they're above the law, right? And the citizens are all subject to the law. And so now you have a dictatorship, an oligarchy, basically.
Oligarchy. You
know, yeah, right. So if you want to see a Republican form of government at its worst, look at Iran, look at some of the Latin American countries. If you want to see a Republican form of government at its best, well, I think we've got a pretty good thing going here, you know, because we have educated people. It's true the American system has been dumbed down, but once you rise up above that ceiling of ignorance, where you get up into the appellate courts, you know, these guys understand it. They, when you present your argument, they know. And it was interesting. This is one of the reasons that I've become a patriot for profit, okay? I know that's a pejorative term normally, but I've decided that I'm going to go lecture touring and see if I can survive off of that. Because if I could put on one seminar a month to pay my basic expenses, this will free me up to do some real research. Let me give you an example of what I did one time. I looked at these codes, and I could tell that somebody, somewhere, has intelligence and is assuring the consistency of the codes. I didn't know where, but I took a guess. I said, one of them has to be the judges, the high judges, you know, Supreme Court and Appellate Court. Something told me that these guys, when I read their writings, you know, I look at their decisions, and I see the reasoning process they go through and so on. So I knew that they knew. Maybe the Superior Court judges weren't so good, and definitely the municipal courts and the small claims courts, that's a bastion of ignorance, okay? But the higher levels, they're great. Then I said, well, look, these laws get passed, the legislature passes them. Well, it turns out that all the laws go through the legislative committee for review. This is where the consistency is assured. That's how they avoid passing bad stuff. So one day, I had some free time, and I drove up to Sacramento because I wanted to research that specific point. How is it that we get this consistency? Where is this intelligence coming from? So the first place I hit was the legislative committee. I went up there and I got a hold of one of the supervisors, because I figured, you know, the Indians usually don't know. But I got a hold of a supervisor, a manager, who was an attorney, who had never been a judge, but was an attorney, was in the legislative committee. So I said, you know, let's talk it over. So I talked it over with him. I wasn't in more than 60 seconds, and I realized here was another jelly bowl full of ignorance. Okay, this person had not a clue. Okay, so, all right, so that considerably changed the direction of my questioning, right? So I said, I got off of that theoretical basis. I got down to brass tacks. I said, just exactly what happens here? How do you work this thing out? You know, here comes a law. I said, I've looked at your work product output, more commonly known as the California codes, and there's this remarkable consistency. What's the process you go through? So he says, well, what we do, the legislature proposes the rules, the laws, comes up with these bills or whatever. We take them and we analyze them. After we analyze them, we have a meeting with the judicial branch. Do I have to say more?
No.
So you see, what's happened is that there are, in our society, only two areas I've been able to locate that really understand these sovereignty concepts. One of them is the judicial, high judiciary. They meet with Supreme Court representatives, okay? And the other bunch is random samplings of people like me. That's it. That's where the real knowledge base is. Also, there's other questions that I want to investigate. For example, there was a guy that was visiting Washington, D.C., and he got a ride with a guy, with a cab driver, black cab driver, okay? Of course, there's a lot of black people in Washington, D.C. And, of course, the cab driver was black. And he said to the cab driver, he said, I'd like to go to the Supreme Court, want to visit that. And the cab driver said to him, well, he says, over there's the good guys, and over there's the bad guys. He knew there were two Supreme Courts. He was tuned into that, amazingly enough. Well, I'd like to go to Washington, D.C., do a little research on that, chase down just then, because I know that the Supreme Court of the United States suspended operations for 1 year. I think it was 1 year. It was about, I don't know, back in the 30s or something like that. Or maybe it was late 1800s, early 1300s. What happened? Well, what happened is I think the original Supreme Court is now known as the Supreme Court of the District of Columbia. That's the real Supreme Court. That's the one that Judge Taney sat in. The Supreme Court we have now is something else. And guess what? You ever heard of Justice Souter?
Yeah.
By the way, do you know the difference between a judge and a justice? Well, all of those persons there sitting on the bench are judges except the ones that are sitting in the Supreme Courts. They're called justices. And the justices, a justice is a common law judge.
Wow.
A judge is a Roman civil law judge. Okay? That's a rough definition of the two. Well, I'd like to go check this out. Okay? I'd like to check out those two Supreme Courts and see what's what. And I understand that the real Supreme Court has two offices. One is in Washington, D.C., and the other is in San Francisco. I'd like to check that out. Yes?
In two courts, they actually call the judge and the justice.
Okay, well, it's something I don't know. It could be. Now, I do know this,
and
that... Okay, great. I do know another thing. You've all heard the flag issue, haven't you? You know, the gold fringe flag in the courts. Well, a friend of mine was telling me that he was running around all over trying to find some specific court for some specific purpose, whatever it is. And he was going into every courtroom looking, trying to find where the courts were. And I'm sure you've seen in all of these courts in Santa Ana that they have gold fringe flags. But he found one court that had no fringe. Why? One courtroom had no fringe. All of them had fringes, but this one didn't. I'm telling you, there's meaning there, but we haven't found it yet. Yes?
I found a courtroom with a flag that doesn't have fringe, and it's in Malibu, Judge Mira's courtroom, and I argued before him that I was not my all capital letters name, yada yada. Anyway, he kind of went along with me.
Uh-huh.
And I was pretty impressed by that.
Yeah, well, see, I think when we get into a real court instead of the admiralty courts, which is what I think that flag represents, but I'm not sure.
I know what it represents.
Huh?
I know what it represents.
Well, I've been told the story, too. My point is that I haven't done the in-depth research to really lock that down.
Title 4. Chapter 1 and 2.
Yeah, that's on here, this disc, by the way. So we
can, all the flags.
Yeah. Well, I don't want to get in discussion about it. I'm just saying that these are research things that popped up as I've been through travel, you know. He had it first.
Okay.
Last night I was reading a book on Justinian law.
What is Justinian law? Uh-huh.
And that is what we're into. I mean, that's what the courts are right now.
Well, that's your Roman civil law.
Yeah.
Yeah, and Justinian, he was a great guy. You'll love him. He would put his signs up so high they couldn't read them and then ticket those people or, you know, arrest them for violating what the sign said. That was who Justinian was. Great guy.
Fine
person. Yes, sir.
Fine for partner.
Right.
I forgot what I was going to say, guys.
Actually, it wasn't that important.
Oh, okay. I was one time, maybe about 6 months ago, looking at some RS information on the web.
Revised statutes.
What's that?
RS, revised statutes.
I don't know. Just general language, what they're using. Okay. And I came across a sentence that they said, please put your name on these forms in all capital letters.
Oh, there you are.
There's something to it.
Right, there is.
I don't know what it is.
Well, we can find these things out. Now, there is a seminar that judges go to.